guys, welcome back once again to Straight Up, the pop culture podcast hosted by us journalists Kathleen and Ellie.
Hello everyone.
Happy to see you, my love.
I'm happy to see you too, my love.
I want to bitch about one thing quickly before we get into today's episode.
Oh, go on, I love a good bitch.
What the hell is the deal with Stanley Cups?
Yes.
So it's not something new. They've obviously been doing the rounds on social media now for months and months and months. They were the Christmas present of the year for tween girls, apparently. But they are just starting to really get my goat. I've had enough. They're ridiculously expensive. They're ridiculously huge. Not that I've ever seen one in real life. But apparently, I saw an article in The Cut last week, they genuinely are now the status symbol for tween girls. So everyone who's anyone at school brings in a Stanley Cup. They've been around a while. They made other kind of cups, boring cups. And then it was only once they brought out this mammoth 40-ounce cup that they literally have skyrocketed a brand. I think their revenue for last year went up by $676 million increase from 2019 to 2023.
Christ.
The company's been around for 100 years, but it's this quencher tumbler that is the big current craze. I'm sure you've seen on socials, they come in like loads of different colours.
Yes, I'm looking at
them. Lots of the
now.
Influencers are all pushing them. Obviously, our fave, Megan Grubb, while I do love her, she is very basic, so I'm not surprised that she'd be a Stanley Cup promoter. And yeah, I just...
So what
do
you put in them?
Because
tea,
water. They're just for water, so hydration. But they're ridiculously expensive. They're huge. And the thing that's pissed me off the most is seeing that now that they're this kind of status symbol in schools, apparently all the girls carry them into school by the handle. Because even though they cost like 50 quid, they leak. You can't put them inside a bag. They go everywhere. They have to be stood up at all times.
This is actually fascinating. Is it because we are now so obsessed with hydration, it's become like a I'm a clean girl, well girl aesthetic thing to always have your bottle of water?
I guess that's part of it, yeah. But it's also just that this cup itself is this signifier of status for young people.
I do find, and I know I sound ancient when I say this, and obviously love a bit of hydration myself. It has been one of my New Year's resolutions of the past year. But when I see people going around to every single meeting clutching their water bottles as if they will literally die if they're not like attached to the tip of it every 2 seconds.
Yes, I agree.
It pisses me off.
My mum's like that. He has to have a bottle of water like all the time, and I find it really annoying. But then I always often want to drink out of it in the car after I've been like, why are you bringing that? You just don't need it.
Well, it's just like these grown adults looking like they're sucking on... what they called baby bottles. What do you call them?
Yeah, I guess baby bottles.
Yeah.
One of my mum's friends said before, and I was like, do you know what? You have a point that incessant water drinking is actually a kind of marketing ploy from the likes of Evian. Because 50 years ago, people did not need to walk around with a bottle of water on them all the time. It wasn't actually necessary.
No.
You can drink more out the tap when you're thirsty. You don't need to have it on you at all time. That's kind of a big myth. Human beings were not designed to be drinking water at all times of day. I would like to know what the status symbol at your school was growing up. I was trying to think,
what
was big in the noughties? What was the thing at school? It was probably gel pens for a time.
Oh yeah, loved my gel pens.
Do you remember they brought out scented ones?
Yes, I do remember the chocolate one.
There was also quite a big thing, and obviously it's come back around now, but Uggs in terms of clothing.
God, they
Uggs
smelled bad when they were wet. Ugh. That's my biggest memory of
that.
The Ugg is how they smelled.
Because they were a big status symbol.
I never had a real Ugg. I always had the fake ones from Primark.
Oh, sad. The ones that would like wear away on
that's
the inside
why they
of
smelt.
People's feet. Yeah,
yeah,
I think that's probably why they smelt, honey. Yeah, I was trying to think what else.
What were those pencil cases with the little monkey on?
I don't know.
Oh, those were, Kipling. Everyone had a Kipling pencil case.
I'm going to have to Google that.
And
I
was like, I
it.
Desperately want a Kipling pencil case. And then, do you know how I got my Kipling pencil case that my parents refused to buy me? I got whacked in the eye by a hockey stick, got a black eye, had to go to hospital.
Aww.
And the girl, as an apology, got me a Kipling pencil case. So it was well worth it, in my opinion.
That is quite good. So the thing with Stanley Cups that I think is sad, as you have just touched on, is they are now a massive source of bullying. In schools.
Because they're so expensive, lots of people can't afford them.
Yeah.
Well,
and they
ridiculous.
Apparently the thing to do with all the tween girls, I saw lots of teachers commenting underneath the cut post. They you have it on your desk. And ideally, if you're really cool, you have several in different colours.
That is preposterous. What? So you can have different waters?
Different water bottles on different days. And my big worry, quite frankly, is just how unhygienic they clearly are. You can't get inside a bottle like that to clean it properly. And the straw, it's like a permanent straw. Can you imagine the bacteria inside of there?
I dread to think. Oh my God.
So I just had to get that off my chest.
So boys don't have them, it's just a girl thing.
Apparently so.
Well, they all need to get a life, quite frankly.
They do, and I've been thinking that about... But fair enough, they are teenagers. But I have been thinking that about the genuine adult influencers that push them.
I have to say, when I first heard of them, I thought it was I thought it was like a tennis awards or something, tennis competition. You know, like the Ryder Cup.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, that's
you
not
You didn't realise it was a physical, literal cup.
No, I thought it was a...
The Stanley Cup!
I thought
you
it was a sporting
it.
Event, yeah.
Well, there's always something that's going to make people feel left out, isn't there? Clearly, teenagers are just as insufferable as they were when we were growing up. Right, let's get into the nuts and bolts of today's episode, shall we? Because, guys, today is a big day. We are finally covering Priscilla. What did you think, hon?
So, I thought it was incredibly dull.
No way, I loved it.
I mean, I liked it, but it was all shot in... I don't know if... Because I watched it illegally. I don't know if I just had a bad copy of it, but it was so dark.
See, I think that was purposeful because she was trying to create the sense of claustrophobia for the viewer that Priscilla was obviously feeling. Guys, if you don't know, it's based on Priscilla Presley's memoir. The film shows how a naive schoolgirl basically became trapped behind the gates of Graceland in a bizarrely codependent relationship with Elvis. Jacob Elordi plays Elvis and Kaylee Spaney is Priscilla.
Yes, and Priscilla is a co-producer on the film and has very much co-signed it, unlike Lisa Marie Presley, who was very disappointed with the way her dad was portrayed in it.
It's a really interesting story because it's very much Priscilla's story. That's what I liked yes. about it. Like Elvis is almost secondary in the narrative.
So yes, I read that Sofia Coppola couldn't get the rights to play the Elvis songs. So that's why she has a completely different soundtrack. But not hearing Elvis's music and his own voice is actually quite powerful because it allows, as you say, space for Priscilla to very much own the narrative herself.
Yeah, I agree. So the film opens in 1959 with Priscilla living in West Germany. She's age 14, where her American Air Force officer father is stationed. A soldier invites her to a party at then 24-year-old Elvis Presley's house, as he was based there for a time during his military service, which I actually didn't know until watching these films about Elvis. But he was, of course, already a massive, massive music star by then. And I think what's so interesting about the film is it's like at once embracing the romance of Priscilla's story, how she told it, you know, in the biography, in that there was an element of fan wish fulfillment. Of course you would be so flattered that Elvis is interested in you. But Sophia very cleverly reframes it so that we see it more as a tale of like coercion.
Yes.
Because of the age dynamic.
Yes. And also even the height difference is a really compelling thing in the film. So Jacob Elordi is 6'5" and Kaylee is 5'1", which isn't actually reflective of Elvis and Priscilla's real height difference.
Yes, he's taller and she's shorter.
Yeah, but in this film, it's so like scary seeing the height difference. Like you're so aware of the fact that she is this tiny little girl. And Sophia has actually said that it was an issue in filming. They had to like put Kaylee on crates and stuff to try, because otherwise you couldn't get them in the same shots.
I read as well that she said she loved that height difference because it really heightened this dynamic of like hunter and prey.
Yes. I mean, I was really conflicted watching it because, I mean, there's the question of the fact that Jacob Elordi, who I love and fancy, is playing this like essential coercive paedophile. So that's weird. But also the fact that actually, and this is purposeful from Sophia and Jacob's point of view, they are showing a more tender side to Elvis in a lot of ways. It's Elvis at home in Graceland, like in his man cave, like in his bedroom, which is very much different to Elvis on stage, Elvis the performer, Elvis the entertainer that we saw in Austin Butler's Elvis. So you see this very tender private side to Elvis, which is then really difficult to reconcile with his abusive moments and the fact that he is a paedophile because he's picking up a child.
The thing is, I do think that she's making comment on the different time periods as well and how our attitudes around what were acceptable have changed. I don't think it's making like a very clear assertion that Elvis was a paedophile.
No, I think it's not making that at all.
Looking into the complicated dynamics, and it has that dual perspective, like we say. So the kind of 1950s idea of femininity are very much present in Priscilla's book. However, this very like modern day perspective, particularly with the like anachronistic music choices, so having like noughties electro party bangers like the Crystal Cat and stuff, kind of shocks the audience into a modern day perspective, but then it wasn't that. You know what I mean?
And actually, Sophia has said on that nuance, I think it would have been easy to make a much darker movie, especially because seeing something unfold on screen can be so much more visceral than reading it. But I didn't want the darker side of their relationship to completely overshadow the film. So it was a matter of trying to show the reality. It was important to Priscilla that it was still her love story and to show Elvis as a real human being rather than a villain.
Yeah, which I think it does. And I think it's obvious why he's damaged. The film hints at the... While the Colonel is never actually shown in Priscilla, they do hint at the kind of... dark power dynamic that's going on behind the scenes, yeah. And you almost wonder whether some of this isn't to validate it, but some of Elvis's bad behavior is a kind of reproduction of the coercive control that he's also experiencing
from Colonel Tom Parker.
Yes. But I really liked a review by Wendy Ide in The Guardian, and she says the film stops short of labeling Elvis as a groomer and Priscilla as his victim. Coppola is more interested in the knotty intricacies of a relationship than buying into binary ideas of guilt and innocence. Plus, she's way too classy to stoop at finger pointing and sensationalism. She's very astute when it comes to the power structures surrounding Elvis, the man and the star. They influence all his relationships, not just the one with Priscilla. And then she goes on to talk about that scene. I'd love to get your thoughts on the scene. So when he takes Priscilla shopping for clothes and the Memphis Mafia all come too.
I wrote this down. I found that scene really disturbing.
I really found that scene to be one of the most powerful of the whole film, because you do get a sense of the incredible power that he has. So yes, he has this kind of cabal of male friends there, but if you notice, they're all reading his responses to the dresses before responding. Like, you can tell that he is by far the most powerful person in that room and that everyone is orbiting around him.
Yes. And it's a classic trope, isn't it, of a coercive, controlling man that they want to dress their wives like little Barbie dolls.
Yes. Hello, Kanye.
Oh, hello, Kanye. I also found watching Elvis with all his friends, there are so many scenes where he's kind of play fighting with them, messing around with them, which again feeds back to this very different side of Elvis that we're seeing in this film, of like Elvis being quite playful, which we don't see in Austin Butler's Elvis. But what I found really difficult about those scenes is seeing Elvis essentially grow up as a young guy with all his mates. But Priscilla is always alone. She's so lonely in the film. She doesn't have any friends.
Yeah, she's totally isolated. And you see her mental state kind of disintegrate the longer she's locked up at Graceland.
Yeah, and seeing those play fighting scenes where Elvis is with his friends and then she's just waiting for him to look at her, completely alone, no one around her.
There's also that scene where they're having a pillow fight and it goes a bit wrong. He's way too hard and punches her, essentially. And it's one of the only times in the film that she stands up to him. And she says, "You always want to win?" Yes. Does she say that?
Yeah, she does say something like that. So, I mean, not that I want to keep pushing that Elvis is a paedophile thing, but I did read a piece about Joel Williamson's controversial book, Elvis Presley, A Southern Life. And he says that when he was on tour, he had a string of girlfriends as young as 14. Williamson details an incident where Elvis would play fight with pillows. Pillow fighting, obviously,
interesting.
A thing for him, with 3 14-year-old fans who he would make like kiss and hug him. And he also had a 15-year-old girlfriend, Dixie Locke.
Oh, this is interesting. I didn't know whether Priscilla was the only one. And perhaps that was almost chance, because they just happened to both be in West Germany. And as he says in the film, you're the only American girl I know.
I think he had a thing for young girls, it seems.
Ew.
So, sorry, guys. I mean, I was looking on Reddit and people get very annoyed if people suggest that Elvis was a paedophile. Yeah. They get really protective of him.
What I found fascinating, though, that I didn't know before about their dynamic, was that while he fetishized Priscilla's age and purity, and for those that don't know, he actually made them wait until after their wedding to even have sex, even though at this point they'd been together for years, she'd moved over to Graceland from Germany. Well, now some biographers do question whether that's accurate. I saw someone questions Priscilla's statement that's what happened. But maybe, I don't know, because what I found really interesting is the way that they explore that while he fetishizes her as this young pure woman, he's also not interested in her sexually. Like, she has to like beg him to be desired in her,
which I found interesting as well, which is I think quite provocative. You're kind of suggesting that the 15-year-old is the one pressuring.
Well, she's not 15 at that point, to be fair. She's like 18, because so the timeline is 1959, when she was 14, they met in Germany. They then didn't reconnect for another 3 years. So by the time she moved over to Memphis,
that's true,
which Elvis encouraged her parents to do. I found it really interesting in the film, almost watching Elvis groom her parents as well. And you watch them become completely starstruck by him.
Well, I actually felt like the dad actually didn't care that Elvis was Elvis. He was more like from military man to military man.
Well, at first, when she's like, "I want to go to a party at Elvis Presley's house," they're like, "You want to go to a party at Elvis Presley's house with a load of strangers? Are you literally insane?" Obviously not. Elvis really did kind of put the charm on them. And when he invited her to come and live with him in Memphis when she was 17, he promised her parents that she would be chaperoned the entire time. Weirdly, she didn't live in Graceland at first. For like the first month or so, she lived down the road with his dad, his very sort of firm father, and was chaperoned by them at all times. Those that have seen the film will also know that she was enrolled in the local Catholic school.
Yeah.
Most of the time, though, Elvis was off performing in musicals and having affairs with Nancy Sinatra.
Oh my God, I felt I was heartbreaking watching Priscilla find out about those affairs. In the newspapers, of course, because...
PR relationships.
Oh, well, yeah.
They've been going a while.
And also to add to the allegations around his predilection for young girls, his private nurse, Letitia Kirk, also said she saw so many teenage girls brought to his Tennessee mansion by his entourage that she actually lost count. One man, the DJ George Klein, was allegedly his pimp. And she says, Letitia says, bringing these little young teenagers up for Elvis to check out, it was a revolving door. I didn't even try to learn their names.
God.
So I think, as we kind of see in the film, he gets this guy to go and collect women for him.
I did wonder at the beginning of the film why this other soldier, Terry, is tasked with bringing Priscilla round to Elvis Presley's house.
Well, like, I guess, I mean, look, it's modern stars do it all the time. Like the number of times that girls get scouted out by someone's security in the front row.
Hey, we were invited to Wu-Tang fans hotel room once.
Oh my God, we did.
Thank God we didn't go.
We'd gone. But I know lots of friends who have been in the front row of concerts and have been asked by like Drake's.
See, I don't. I feel like you always hear those stories, but I've never once heard about that actually happening.
Oh, I have.
By whom?
Drake.
And they went back to Drake's hotel?
No, they didn't because they were underage.
Right.
So this is the issue, is that they don't, it's security will come and ask girls in the front row, like hot ones, do you want to come backstage? And depending on, and they won't check their age.
I think I said this recently on air, but as he gets older, I'm finding Drake more and more tragic. Like recently when he was posting the photos of all the bras that get thrown at him, I'm like, get a grip, mate. You're in your late 30s. Like, you're a dad. Why do you care if bras are being thrown at the stage at this point? Go and focus on your artistry.
Yes,
you loser.
Definitely need to do that.
That's how I feel.
Also, we've had so many stories about Drake at this point.
Yeah. I think what's really interesting with Priscilla as well is just how they show Elvis to be controlling beyond the age dynamic. So for years, he would control how she did her makeup, how she did her hair. It's he that pushes her to have this makeover with the kind of absurd beehives and heavy black eyeliner. He also prevented her from having a job when she asked.
Yeah, said it's me or the career, baby.
And he was like, you're not going to be there to answer the phone for me. You won't be at home to answer the phone when I need you, so no.
He also made her have a collection of handguns to match her different outfits.
That was very strange.
And also, I had a look at some of the stuff from the autobiography, from Priscilla's actual autobiography. And he would tap her on the head if she frowned because he didn't want her to get wrinkles. He used to take her to the local morgue to scare her. He was so worried about her putting on weight when she was pregnant. He said, women use the excuse of their pregnancy to let themselves go.
Oh my God.
Cathers, quick question for you. How much do you love film soundtracks? I've got really into them recently because I got obsessed with the Poor Things soundtrack. And the Priscilla soundtrack I am also loving, and it sounds extremely good on our Jet earphones from Flare Audio.
Yes, I've got to say, I do love a little film soundtrack. I'm obsessed with the Priscilla one, especially the Ramones track at the start, and I bloody love our Jet earphones as well. The clarity is just next level thanks to Flare's very clever tech. And also, I have to say, they are so reasonably priced. I've currently still got the Idol soundtrack on repeat. It's been a while, but you know how much I love The Weeknd.
I am still banging that one out as well. Guys, you can hear so much detail in the tracks with these Jet earphones that you can't with other earphones, even the most expensive ones. Also, the bass is amazing. There's no distortion. And I've heard Stephen Fry is a fan.
Fun fact. So guys, head to flareaudio.com to get your Jet and E prototype earphones now. And in fact, very good news, they are currently on sale until the end of Jan. So get your pair with 20% off if you hurry.
And lastly, guys, Flare have a very good competition going on right now on their Instagram to win a pair of Jet earphones completely free. All you've got to do is follow Flare Audio on Instagram, comment on their recent Elvis and Priscilla post saying what your favourite movie soundtrack is, and good luck.
Do make sure you follow us at Straight Up Pod as well. I did find the whole pregnancy thing really sad. So guys, again, if you haven't seen it, this isn't really a spoiler because I feel like when it's biographical, it's different. She got pregnant very, very quickly after they got married and is clearly quite devastated about it because they'd finally found closeness in their relationship and they had these plans for her to go with him on a Europe tour.
Yeah, I found that
devastating. And then she's like knocked up instantly and just trapped in Graceland.
And you can tell he's kind of thrilled that she'll be contained.
He gets rid of her, yeah.
Yeah. And I think you mean there's a shot of her applying her false eyelashes before she goes to hospital, which Sophia has said was really important because it just shows how much Elvis forced her to focus on her looks, to never let go of her looks.
Yeah.
And he was just obsessed with her being essentially a doll. And in fact, Priscilla writes in her autobiography, "I was Elvis's doll, his own living doll to fashion as he pleased. While my classmates were deciding which colleges to apply to, I was deciding which gun to wear with what sequin dress."
God, I thought the costume was brilliant, wasn't it, in the film? It's done so,
so
well, and I think it really speaks to the kind of transitions that she goes through. So, as in Priscilla, sorry. So earlier on in the film, she's wearing kind of very fussy 1950s tailoring, lots of bows, and she'll wear these court shoes that are clearly too big for her. And she very much does look like a little girl dressing up in women's clothing.
So Kaylee Spaney is 25 years old, and I did find, and she looks so young, and I did find that quite difficult in the film, was there is literally no difference in terms of her looks from the moment we see her at 14, 15 to when she's meant to be like in her, I guess, early 20s. Like, I find she looks exactly the same.
Oh, I didn't. So I saw the evolution.
Well, only her clothes.
And the hair, like the 70s version of her looked so 70s with the sequined outfit and then the like honeyed, glossy kind of Amazonian supermodel hair. It was so 70s, that look. I thought some of the saddest scenes were the ones where he would like command her to pack up and leave and say, go and visit your parents or you need to leave. And then would change his mind a few seconds later. And she eventually knew how to play him in that she'd be like, okay, fine, I will. And then suddenly he's shouting from down the corridor, like, don't, I didn't mean it. It was just such a toxic relationship.
That's the thing. It's so clear with all these toxic relationships, all these coercive relationships, that the key to coercing someone is isolation. And she is isolated in this enormous mansion. She doesn't have any friends. She doesn't have anyone to talk to. So when he leaves her, what's she going to do? She's got no one to go back to. She's terrified of going back to the small, tiny life that her parents symbolized for her, where she was bored out of her mind. So where can she is literally her whole world. And that is...
She's trapped, yeah.
She's completely trapped.
Sofia Coppola has such a knack for like capturing that very specific worldview glimpsed through the bars of a gilded cage as well. That's her thing. So obviously there's five-star kind of hotel depression in Lost in Translation. Then there's like the beautiful prison of privilege that Marie Antoinette is in. Now this dark fairy tale of Priscilla.
And the suppressed women of the Virgin Suicides.
Yes. Also starring Kirsten Dunst.
Yes.
Side note, I love Marie Antoinette featuring Kirsten Dunst. I know loads of people hate that film, but it's one of my proper favourites.
I know. I watched it for the first time in lockdown and hated it.
Okay, so I had it on DVD like when I was young. Yeah. That was a film I loved as a teenager. So I don't think I've even watched it in the last 10 years, but it's a proper comfort movie for me.
Yeah, people, it's a Marmite movie. I was interested in reading from the writer Bethan Roberts, who has written extensively about Elvis and Priscilla, an early life-changing moment that she believes suggests why Priscilla was kind of so vulnerable to being groomed by Elvis. So Priscilla briefly describes her early life as a daughter of a very strict army captain. And she discovered when she was 13 that he was not her real father.
Yes.
So her mother then asked her to keep this a secret in order to protect her stepfather's pride.
How does she find out?
I don't know, actually. But the incident is never mentioned again, but seems to colour everything that follows. So Priscilla was perfect for Elvis, Bethan writes, because she was already so good at keeping her mouth shut. Also, Bethan writes, she was known as the prettiest girl in school. She was crowned Queen of Del Valle Junior High. And as an Air Force child, she had lived in 6 different cities by the time she was 11. So, Priscilla writes in her autobiography, fearful of not being accepted, I either kept to myself or waited for someone to befriend me. So, says Bethan, Priscilla had already learned a way to keep up appearances, keep your head down, your eyes open, your mouth shut.
I found it really sad, the scene where she goes to LA, despite Elvis not wanting her to ever visit him on set, and confronts him about him potentially having affairs, and he essentially like punches her and says that she has to deal with it.
Yeah. He says something really disturbing, like, are you going to be the kind of woman that like makes things easier for me or something like that? He makes it
feel... I need a woman that will support this or something.
He never denies
essentially
it.
About like PR relationships, but almost then hinting that he needed to have affairs with his co-stars in order to promote the films. What I found really interesting watching Elvis, as in the Baz Luhrmann Elvis, is that the Colonel definitely wanted Elvis to marry Priscilla and organise these key moments in their lives as positive press as well.
Yes.
So people say that Elvis actually didn't even particularly want to marry Priscilla. He was actually kind of miffed about it. Priscilla says in her autobiography that she would have been quite happy not to get married, even though part of the deal with her parents and Elvis was always that they would marry eventually. She would have been happy if it was the done thing in that era just to live together. It obviously, I guess, wasn't. But the Colonel specifically engineered the wedding, which apparently was so depressing. And I think they capture that in the film. It's like a press conference. Mm. They had a very small wedding in Vegas, then a press conference where they were both clearly miserable. And then they went off in Frank Sinatra's jet or something. But that's portrayed in such a depressing way in the Priscilla film. Yet in the Elvis film, because it's from the Colonel's viewpoint, he's like, it was a Hollywood romance. It was the wedding of dreams. And he makes it look like they have a fairy tale life.
Yeah.
And in fact, I don't think Elvis would have necessarily even, you know, had a baby with her and done the photo shoot on the front of the hospital steps and all the rest of it if he didn't think that it was good for his image because the Colonel wanted him to.
Very good point.
Should we explain who the Colonel is, actually, for listeners that don't know?
Yes. So Colonel Tom Parker was his long-standing manager who actually turned out to be a massive fraud. He is the main character, really, in the Baz Luhrmann Elvis film, I would say. So and watch that.
Yeah.
As it's narrated
He's played by Tom Hanks.
Oh, he's so good.
And he basically financially abused Elvis. All this didn't come out until after Elvis had died, but the Elvis Baz Luhrmann film does show how the Colonel essentially managed to entrap Elvis by setting up Elvis Presley Enterprises and being the co-owner of that business.
Yes, and a bit like the way Elvis traps Priscilla in a cage.
Yeah.
Colonel Tom Parker wouldn't let Elvis travel outside of America because he didn't, it turns out that he was a fraud because he never had a passport. Because he was not who he said he was.
He wasn't born in America.
Exactly.
Even though Elvis believed that till the day he died.
Exactly. So he wasn't even a colonel. So that was all a lie. So it meant that he didn't want Elvis to go and see the world and make a lot more money touring because he couldn't leave the US.
Yeah, and there was one point where Elvis really wanted to leave the Colonel because he was extremely upset after an incident with Baron Hilton, funnily enough, Paris Hilton's grandfather. Essentially, he'd gone to visit a hotel member of staff's wife who was really unwell with cancer, and Baron Hilton found out and the guy was fired because hotel employees weren't allowed to fraternize with hotel talent. Elvis was so upset by this and furious. So while the scene in the Elvis movie where he fires the Colonel on stage didn't actually happen, what did happen is Elvis was incredibly angry about this Hilton incident and went off raging about that on stage. And then he and the Colonel had like hours worth of rows after it. Elvis threatened to leave. And so the Colonel wrote up this huge contract, which was allegedly between, people did say between like $2 million and $10 million, saying, well, this is what you owe me. So if you want to leave, you have to pay this. And Elvis eventually decided that he couldn't afford it and therefore had to go back to work for the Colonel.
Right. God.
So what did you think of the Baz Luhrmann Elvis? Because I have to say, watching it post Priscilla, I didn't love it. I know Austin Butler was nominated for an Oscar. I know the whole world went completely crazy for him. But I preferred Jacob Elordi's dark, smouldering Elvis. I just did.
What did I think? I think as a film, I found Baz Luhrmann's Elvis much more entertaining. I mean, it was a bit unfair of me at the start of this episode to say this, Priscilla's very dull. I think I found it quite a slow-moving psychological portrait. I think, to be honest, I wasn't that interested in Kayleigh Spaney's version of Priscilla.
Really? Because I thought she was so good and I hated, well, that's a bit of a strong word. We'll have to check her name. Did not like the Priscilla of Elvis, as in Luhrmann's Elvis, at all. That actress did not do it for me. Didn't buy it.
I think part of the issue is that Priscilla is meant to be this very contained, silent, trapped woman in the film. So that not much happens.
But there's a very big scene where they first meet and they're chatting in Germany in her sort of teenage bedroom. They make her actually seem a lot more confident and knowing than she does as a sort of 14-year-old in Priscilla.
Yes, I think there are some people who I think their faces can act like on their own, like just their expression itself can carry so much. I didn't find Kayleigh's face that interesting to watch in terms of, I didn't find it that powerful, because with that kind of role, really it all plays out on the face, right? The eyes. I didn't find that compelling.
Oh, I really did. And I found Jacob Elordi so compelling, even though Austin Butler actually on paper looks more like Elvis with the blue eyes.
Yeah,
I found the kind of complicated, brooding, dark Jacob Elordi Elvis so much more compelling than the kind of simpleton Austin Butler version. For me, I know it's a Baz Luhrmann film, obviously it's meant to be all singing, all dancing, but the Elvis pyrotechnics totally got in the way for me. It just felt like it was a never-ending Elvis tribute act going.
I do know what you mean.
Whereas I loved that there was no Elvis music really in Priscilla, because that didn't then overshadow or take away from her story.
Yes. I think it's a very good film and very worthwhile and like...
Oh, come round, have you? No, not
I
just... dull.
I can see why it's a good film and why it's important to spotlight Priscilla's story and why it had to be filmed in the way it was. But I just personally found it a bit of a slog, because I know this is bad, but I just wanted more Jacob Elordi in it. Because Elvis is just more interesting to watch, like, because of his life. Like, she actually... Priscilla's life is so boring, bless her, because of what she's had to suffer.
But you did really get glimpses of... the Elvis show, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
like I
said,
these hints at the Colonel being on the phone, or their first weekend in Vegas, and the very first weekend that she has in Graceland, where they're doing like uppers and downers. He introduces her to drugs and she loses 2 days.
I know, that was insane.
That was wild, wasn't it?
Oh, poor, I mean, what's really interesting, and it's clear from the last scene, actually, where you see Priscilla driving away to the sound of Dolly Parton's I Will Always Love You. Because the thing...
She's empowered.
Yeah, the contradiction of Priscilla is super interesting. In her autobiography, even though she's quite candid about the fact that he raped her and abused her and punched her and all these things, she still loves him.
So one thing I will say on the rape... allegation perhaps, is that in the film they show it as he says, this is how a real man makes love to his woman, and she kind of pushes him off. It's in a hotel room in the 70s after a show, and she runs off. Apparently, I looked into this because I was like, wow, did that really happen? Priscilla kind of did a 180 on that after it went live in the book. She says it was a poor choice of words and that he didn't actually force himself on her, and that actually he was just attempting a reconciliation that came too late, i.e. that reconciliation being, oh, he's finally interested in her sexually after like decades of her wanting him to desire her when he didn't.
Right, yes, because in the autobiography she says he forced him. Yeah.
But isn't that interesting in and of itself in terms of gender power dynamics, in terms of sexual dynamics, in terms of how different eras, things are perceived differently?
Yes, very true. And I mean, Priscilla now is very involved with the Elvis estate. She's essentially single-handedly brought it back from the brink of bankruptcy by opening Graceland to the public. And she's always been incredibly committed to Elvis. So I think it's interesting to have those contradictions.
Yeah, like when they left the courthouse, when their divorce was finalised, they left holding hands.
Yeah,
she's quite sweet.
And she
a little dysfunctional.
She never remarried because she believed, in her words, that no one could ever match him, and she didn't think that Elvis would be able to handle it. Also,
the film only slightly hints at this at the end, where you see Priscilla getting into karate, but she actually did have her own affairs.
I
dug into the actual history.
A dance instructor, a karate teacher, a lawyer, an actor, and a producer. I don't think these are all during the Elvis relationship, but maybe the karate one
is. Karate
that
was marked someone. Yeah.
I know, I loved that for her.
I know, it was quite fabulous, wasn't it?
So Lisa Marie, as I touched on at the beginning, his daughter, who has now tragically died, said, my father only comes across as a predator and manipulative. As his daughter, I don't read this and see any of my father in this character. Read as in she read the script before it was made. I am worried that my mother isn't seeing the nuance here or realizing the way in which Elvis will be perceived when this movie comes out.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So that almost suggests that Priscilla is so trapped in her era that she wasn't anticipating the modern reading.
Yes, but I think so. Priscilla has seen the film and is happy with it. I mean, to be fair, it's kind of what we were saying. It is really difficult because it is also a love story. Like, it's
a fucked up love story.
Yeah. And that's why I was saying I find that it really difficult watching Jacob Elordi, because you do see him being really tender and lovely in moments.
Definitely. And when he's a young soldier, he's so charming.
Yeah, but his charming is also really fucked up because he's calling her little one and things like that. Like, you're like, oh, good, he doesn't want to have sex with her because she's still a child. Like, he's being protective. But also, there's something really weird about that as well, that he's kind of just keeping this child warm.
Well, it is odd when they have the first conversation at this party in West Germany and he asks her what year she's in. He's like, are you a freshman or a junior? And she's like, neither, I'm in the ninth grade. And he's like, oh, so you're just a baby. Okay, I'll see you next week. A bit weird.
And also when he leaves her for the first time after they've started seeing each other, and he goes, promise me you'll stay exactly the way you are now.
Yes.
He clearly doesn't want her to age.
Yes. Very creepy.
Yeah.
Apparently, to prepare, Jacob Elordi read, obviously, Priscilla's book, but eBayed old DVDs of Elvis's performances and watched all his, like, YouTube videos until he was certain that he'd basically seen every single piece of footage that existed of Elvis. He kept an extensive notebook. He spoke to Priscilla on the phone. And apparently, they bonded over their shared love of animals. And Priscilla really liked Jacob and thought he was fantastic. I mean, who wouldn't?
we're going to get onto Jacob soon. And he took her as his date, I think, to the premiere.
Cute.
Priscilla, yeah.
Fun fact as well. We've touched on this recently of how much men are able to do this and women aren't. But yes. Apparently Jacob stayed in The Voice the entire time he was on set.
Yes. Which is really weird because he was filming Saltburn in the day.
He filmed Saltburn and then started Priscilla 3 weeks later.
I heard him say on a podcast that he would film Saltburn in the day and then in the evening he would go back to his hotel that was essentially Elvis's man cave, full of pictures of Priscilla on the walls. He would listen to Elvis's music. So he said the films are weirdly like conjoined in his head.
Yes. One thing I found really interesting about that is reading the recent GQ profile of Jacob Elordi. He's asked whether Sofia Coppola is his favourite director. And he says, yes, essentially. He says, it's pretty fun to completely trust somebody because it just alleviates so much stress and worry. The journalist then asks if that's been his usual experience with directors. And he says, not at all, not once up until now. Well, all the promo for Saltburn, he's bigging up Emerald Fennell on this crazy level. But perhaps she had more of a bond with Barry because I just found it fascinating that Priscilla was started filming 3 weeks after Saltburn wrapped. I would have thought he would big up Emerald to the same degree.
Very good point.
Mm, clearly much preferred Sofia.
So we've got to get into all the gossip around Jacob Elordi. Yeah. It was wonderful preparing for this episode
Watching. A Jacob Elordi wormhole. So he's 26 years old. He's 6'5". He grew up working class in Brisbane, Australia. I would like to take a very quick tangent here and ask you on the topic of Brisbane, if you have watched Boy Swallows Universe yet, one of my recos from last week.
I haven't, babe. I've just been mainlining Traitors.
You've got to. Honestly, guys, I hadn't seen the full series when I spoke about it last week. It's just incredible.
This was Kath made me want to watch that. And
it's all set in working class Brisbane.
Oh,
anyway,
okay.
Jacob's dad was a house painter and his mum worked in the cafeteria at his school. He's a big fan of his mum, definitely a mama's boy. And it was a teacher that encouraged him to try out for his first play. Sometime after his mum got an inkling that her son would perhaps be an actor. And little by little, he set his sights on Hollywood.
He was practicing his American accent from the age of 14.
So cute. Jacob is definitely one of those actors that takes his craft incredibly seriously, isn't he?
Yes, and I reckon this might haunt him at some point because I can already see a kind of reaction around his pretentiousness that does creep in every now and then around his craft that Jeremy Strong was ridiculed for very recently. There was a big New Yorker profile of Jeremy Strong just kind of near the end of Succession that was absolutely lampooned for just revealing how serious Jeremy Strong is. And I think he's the next Daniel Day-Lewis. And Brian Cox was just like fucking annoying the way Jeremy Strong is always method acting. Like, it's just a job. Just like get it done and go home and start annoying us all. And I do worry that Jacob Elordi might suffer the same delusions of grandeur. Not delusions, because he is, I mean,
he's just young and earnest at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, because I think people have been really pissed off with some of the ways that he has completely condescended, for instance, superhero films. Basically said, no, I'm not doing them.
But I think that was fair enough. I found that quote really interesting, actually. So he was asked in the GQ profile, could you see yourself in a superhero film? And he said, not particularly, no. I've always been told to say a rounded answer or my agent will get mad at me. Anything can happen, he says with false cheer. And obviously anything can happen. But at this stage in my life, I don't see myself having any interest in that. I like to make what I would watch and I get very restless watching those movies. And then he does say he's making it clear that he's not knocking that style of film or those actors. It's just not for him. I do think that's fair enough. If you like film noir, then good for you, honey.
I mean, yeah, I've heard a lot of actors say when they give advice to young actors, don't do a superhero film. That's actually a thing. If you're going to be seen as a serious actor, do not box yourself in too young, like maybe Tom Holland has. Like, it's true, Tom Holland, who's been Spider-Man, could we see him in a serious film?
Not really.
Not really.
And I think Jacob Elordi literally looks like Clark Kent, doesn't he? So if he was in a superhero film, he would then be, I suppose, like a Chris Pratt style actor more than he would this like brooding serious guy.
I guess the route you want is to maybe Benedict Cumberbatch doing lots of serious films and then you end up as Doctor Strange.
But also Doctor Strange is like a not very like traditionally superhero. Do you know what I mean? He does touch on the pretension thing in the GQ profile. The quote is, here's something Elordi can't quite understand. Ever since he was making his teen films and feeling dissatisfied and being told he should just be grateful, being told he was pretentious, he says, how is caring about your output pretentious? But not caring and knowingly feeding people shit, knowing that you're making money off people's time, which is literally the most valuable thing they have. How is that the cool thing?
I mean, I hear that.
I do hear that.
I hear that. Another thing that adds to this feeling that he maybe thinks he's a bit too cool for school, or rather not cool isn't the right word, but wants to be taken incredibly seriously, is the way he bashes like Vogue and GQ's little YouTube formats.
He was hating it, wasn't he? That GQ one where he's talking about the things he loves and they're literally like Australia, animals, poetry. He just says at the start, these are self-explanatory.
Literally.
Als, I am so excited. I have some fabulous news to share with you that's defo going to make our January feel a bit brighter.
Oh, thank God, babe. Tell me right this instant.
So Yonder have added the most delicious drinking and dining partners to its January experiences. I can't quite cope. I am dying to tell you about them so we can pick one and go together for a much-deserved New Year's treat.
Stunning. Go on, Cappers.
Okay, so we can choose between Hobson, King's Cross, one of my faves, Frenchy in Covent Garden, Italian Spot Artusi in Peckham, Gastropub The Bull and Last in Highgate, Seafood Restaurant Orisay in Notting Hill, Correggios for Mexican in Stoke Newington, Thai Place Plaza in Tottenham Court Road, Arcade Food Hall, also on the Tottenham Court Road, and Deep Breath, Kalai, a Thai restaurant in London Bridge from the founders of Somsa, lovely, and our fave cocktail bar, Swift in Soho.
I am salivating. We've got to go to them. Plaza I've actually been to, proper, authentic, no-frills Thai food, obsessed. And Swift is one of my favourite cocktail bars. They do the best Irish coffees in London. And Frenchy looks so bougie. It's been on my special occasion list for years.
Well, babe, you can actually get a lot of the build paid for with your points. How great is that? So guys, if you don't already know, Yonder is a lifestyle credit card that allows you to collect points for every pound you spend. And these points are then redeemable at Yonder's monthly changing selection of partners across food, fitness, drink, wellness. It's all in London and there's travel across the UK and even online shopping.
I have about 100 quid's worth of points right now, which means I can probably get an entire meal for two completely free with Yonder.
Lucky. Thank you so much to our amazing partner, Yonder. Get your first month free and 10,000 points when you join, then £15 a month thereafter. Please make sure you borrow responsibly. T's and C's apply. Rep 66.7% APR variable.
So the GQ writer, Gabriella Paella, says, he mentions a gimmicky video premise in which he's blindfolded and being fed certain foods and having to put on a show trying to guess what the food is. A banana, for instance. And then Elodie says, and you're a fucking grown man. That stuff's embarrassing. Then also you watch me choke on a banana with a blindfold on. How will you believe me when it's 1943 and I'm a prisoner of war doing surgery on somebody? I just funny. Saw him with a banana halfway down his throat on fucking YouTube. Yeah. I was like, do you know what? That is fair. That is actually fair.
I can see why actors hate that. The promo cycle. I found it very funny though in that GQ video where he talks about the things he likes. Again, just this balance of the kind of sincere and him trying to be taken seriously, bless his little heart. He has this whole long thing in the Vogue video about his love of film noir. But he, and I know you will appreciate this, did you see? He is a Fred Again fan.
Oh my God, I didn't see that.
Yes. He lists him as one of his favourite artists. I mean, alongside like Bon Iver.
Is that an ick? It's an ick.
It's a slight ick. I could not wait to tell you when I saw that.
Oh my God.
And I have another one for you.
Oh no, what?
When he talks about the poetry he loves, he reads his favourite lines from the poems.
You're kidding.
It's like a Philip Larkin poem.
And then no. And also, he even says, for no reason at all, during the GQ interview, that his favourite piece of writing ever is Truman Capote's
1957 New Yorker profile of Marlon Brando.
And it's like, oh my God. Again, it's what I was saying last episode. It's like, just stop showing your like reverence to the greats quite so much.
It's
okay?
It gets to the point where it feels insincere. It was also quite funny how the writer wrapped up the piece because she then tells him that in fact Marlon Brando hated that profile and he didn't even know that. He's like, oh.
But to be fair, and I kind of 180 on me saying he thinks he's too cool for school, because actually this is an earnestness that suggests he doesn't care that people think he's taking his job really seriously, because actually being really nonchalant about it would probably be cooler.
Yes.
And he's not doing that.
He is sort of nonchalant at the same time though, isn't he? There's just something like so at once sort of effortless but also intellectual about him, and I guess that's kind of the dichotomy that his characters have often encapsulated. Like Nate Jacobs in Euphoria is at once the kind of jock but also incredibly fucked up and complicated.
So let's talk about Euphoria quickly, because I am not sure that season three of Euphoria is a good look for Jacob Elordi right now, particularly because he's trying to be so serious. He's got two very serious films coming up. Paul Schrader, known for First Reformed and known as like one of Hollywood's like most respected scriptwriters, his film O Canada.
Yes, he's going to be playing a young version of the character played by Richard Gere, quite iconic for Jacob.
Yes, and also Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein, Elordi is going to be Frankenstein.
Pan's Labyrinth.
Yes, so how is Euphoria season three going to fit in terms of like what he's trying to do with his image?
Well, I think Euphoria is so wildly popular and people see it as so arty that actually it fits perfectly. He even spoke the other day on Jimmy Fallon about how Leonardo DiCaprio has once told him he's a huge fan of his work on Euphoria. he talked about filming it again next year. I think people love it so much and it is so kind of arty that it actually fits perfectly with this image of him as a real thespian.
It's true, and it is an A24 production as well. A24 is so respected artistically and have like a cult following. So some Euphoria gossip. Apparently, Zendaya and Jacob Elordi did not end their relationship on good terms. And apparently, Hunter Schafer had beef with Elordi as well because the Reddit sleuths realised that Hunter deleted pictures of Elordi from her profile and then unfollowed him for a while. And they also noticed that when they were doing promo together for Euphoria, all the Euphoria cast were like stuck together, but Elordi was always like on his own, not with them. So they felt like there was friction. There was also rumors that Hunter did not want to do any more scenes with Jacob, and the Cassie Nate storyline was meant to carry on being Jules and Nate, Jules being Hunter's character, but because of Hunter's beef with Jacob, that was switched over to Cassie.
God.
Which I did feel was quite a random storyline actually when I was watching it.
Well, he's had quite a interesting dating history. He's gone out with quite a few of his leading ladies as well as Zendaya. He also had a relationship with his Kissing Booth co-star Joey King.
Which also, and Joey King also really didn't end well with him because she was very upset with the way he criticised the Kissing Booth.
Yeah, and he's dated Kaya Gerber.
Did that end well?
We don't know, but then he got together with Olivia Jade. So guys, if you don't know, Olivia Jade is the influencer who is the daughter of Lori Loughlin, who's the actor that was convicted in the college application scandal. Olivia Jade and Jacob have had this kind of what seems to be on and off relationship. So they first got together in like 2021, 22, and then they reportedly split in August 2022, but then they reconciled later and were seen vacationing together in Italy in June 2023. Then in mid-July, they were also spotted spending time with Olivia Jade's parents in Idaho. And yeah, they've never gone on the record about their relationship, but they're constantly seen together in public.
Apparently she was out and about with him whilst he was preparing for SNL.
Yes, that's when she was most recently pictured with him, and everyone thought that they'd split up, but she was there supporting him at rehearsals, so clearly not.
Again, on Reddit, someone was like...
You're obsessed with Reddit.
I know. Well, it's where I get loads of stories. We commissioned the Telegraph come from Reddit.
That's so funny.
Yeah, a fan was saying that she has bumped into him so many times and he's always lovely. All the fan anecdotes of bumping into him seem to be like, he's really polite, really nice.
Yeah.
But Olivia apparently wouldn't take her sunglasses off and was a little madam.
Well, I could imagine that. I mean, if you're a massive YouTuber who also has actor parents and has also been burnt by the tyranny of a terrible story going public. Do you know what I mean? Like, she has had a real bashing in the press.
Fair.
So if I were her, I would also be quite a skeptic, I think. But one thing I have to say in terms of like pap shots of Jacob is how iconic is his collection of handbags?
Yes, which he was also grilled on in the GQ interview. And he was like, I've never bought any of them.
Yeah, he was basically like, I was gifted all of them. And that's what I do like about Jacob though. He kind of does deconstruct like fame. He's obviously quite jaded by Hollywood. He's very real.
Yes, I actually really empathise with what he said about the process of celebrity interviews. He said he didn't like them because I'm wary of having any kind of absolute. I almost feel like for me, I change every single step I take. That's why I really, really, really don't like interviews because you set in stone something as an absolute.
Yeah, fair enough.
Which is what we've said in the past. Like,
you grow and you change, especially at that age, I guess. If he's literally been famous throughout his early 20s, you would feel like, God, something I said at 19 doesn't really reflect who I am now.
Yes, exactly. And also what we've said previously, where just this random journalist who spent 1 hour with you or two has just decided this is what
that's your life story.
Yeah. And this is how you're going to be seen for like thousands of readers.
I feel like the GQ profiler was definitely trying to present him as a kind of golden retriever boyfriend. There's even a specific moment where he sees a golden retriever and goes and pats him on the head and is like, who's a big boy? Who's a big boy? And they clearly show that he's this big dog lover, animal lover. I don't know. I think it's definitely an attempt to kind of soften him, but also show that he is this like big, lovely, silly puppy himself.
Yes. And the fact that he's able to then play these incredibly dark, toxic men on screen is revealing of, I guess, how versatile he is.
Yes.
He is really cute when Ellen quizzes him on his nude scenes in Euphoria. He goes so red, bless him, and like keeps crossing and uncrossing his legs. And he's like dying. I feel like, actually, this is wild. Just this random person just like asking you how you felt to have your kit out on screen. I mean,
he's just so like masculine.
But he's also got a very feminine manner to him in a nice way.
Yes, and I think that works so beautifully because he's so traditionally like handsome and macho that it then softens him in a way that just makes him irresistible to women.
So hot take that might not be popular. If Elordi wasn't so hot,
yes,
would we all think he was such a good actor? Have we conflated thirst with skill?
I definitely think there is a bit of conflation going on, or at least there is in my heart.
Certainly is.
However, he's been great in all the films that I've seen him in. To be fair, he was brilliant in Euphoria, brilliant in Saltburn, brilliant in Priscilla. Like, I actually do genuinely think he feels truly like the character in each film. It's not just, oh, there's Jacob with either long hair, short hair, whatever. It doesn't just feel Jacob with a different hairstyle to me.
So I have gossip. I can't reveal who said this, but quite a well-known actor said he thought Jacob Elordi was very much letting the side down and people just were fawning over him because he was hot, but he was a terrible actor.
Yeah, but I bet you the person that said that is not conventionally attractive. Oh, interesting. Well, yeah, not conventionally attractive though.
Yeah, bit jealousy.
Yeah, a bit jealousy there. Coppola told GQ that she cast Elordi in part because in their first meeting at a restaurant, there were girls there and you could feel them all just turn and look at him. He was so striking, so tall, and he just has that charisma and he has effect on women that I do imagine was similar to Elvis.
Also, Australian accent always does it for me.
I found it interesting how he said that he kind of hates America and that Australians and Americans are actually very, very different. He said, if Australians are like freshwater fish, Americans are saltwater fish. It kind of looks the same. The water is water. You're swimming around, but you can't breathe.
Yes, I thought that was good. I mean, I think Australians are just so much more...
Friendly.
Friendly.
That's what he said. He misses the camaraderie of Australia, the mateship, as he calls it. He thinks it just feels a lot more isolated and people are a lot more like closed in on themselves. I've never actually even been to Australia, so I can't speak with much expertise. I'd love to go to Australia.
But I've always had a great time with Australians. They've always been so nice.
I absolutely love Australians. They're always so fun. They're always up for a good time.
They're just relaxed as well. We Britons desperately need Australian friends.
We do, because we're so uptight.
We're so uptight. So we should try and be friends with Jacob Elordi, ideally.
Right, how are we going to make that one happen? I think that is going to be quite tricky. I mean, it is quite sweet, isn't it, that he's having his moment. Like, after not having a major film out for years, despite having found success, being relegated to the realms of teenage heartthrob, you can't help but be happy for him that he's getting everything he ever wanted in his wildest dreams.
I am happy for him.
I'm super happy for him. I think he deserves it.
But I am also really happy that contractually he is obliged to do a third season of Euphoria.
I know, me too. Me too.
Because it has been confirmed. They're all coming back.
Yeah, they just don't know when it's going to shoot.
At some point, though, I mean, he doesn't want to get boxed in only playing psychopathic, toxic men.
Yeah.
And also, it's almost easier to play against your personality in that way. And also someone who is so...
But Felix Catton in Saltburn is lovely and nice and quite pure. He's not at all... toxic.
Oh, that's interesting. I kind of see him as toxic, though, also.
I've seen Emerald Fennell say he was meant to be, like, the epitome of niceness. That was the kind of point of the character. Yeah, he's just a lovely person, even though he's moneyed and all the rest of it and come from an incredibly privileged background and has obviously a limited perspective. He's supposed to be genuinely good and kind of radiate sunshine, and that's why people are drawn to him. And she uses the example of the scene in the bar where Oliver doesn't have any money in his wallet to pay for the Jägermeisters.
Oh, yes.
And he comes over and says, oh, then you drop some money and pays for them.
Fine. I think maybe it's because he's a posh twat also.
And the film itself is so dark, you almost then just think of every kind of character as twisted and dark.
Yes. I guess I didn't like the fact that he was using Oliver just to make his life a bit more interesting in that moment. I mean, the fact that he's drawn to Oliver is because Oliver has this allegedly fucked up backstory and Felix loves that because it gives him an edge.
I think the quote that he gave in the Vogue video, 24 Hours with Jacob Elordi, was also quite telling in terms of what he's drawing on to play these dark, twisted characters. So he says, the most heinous, awful people in the world, there's always a story behind it that came from trauma and kind of tragedy. It doesn't validate their actions, but I think it's good to have empathy and sit back and realise everyone comes from somewhere. I feel like he's trying to encapsulate that in all his roles. You know, whether it's Nate Jacobs in Euphoria, Elvis, he's simultaneously ominous but vulnerable.
Yes.
And Jacob hits that sweet spot perfectly.
Do you know what we're probably never going to see him in, and probably because he wouldn't be that good in it, is a comedy. I cannot imagine him doing
comic timing.
And he actually, and he actually says that in his interview with Jimmy Fallon about SNL, is that he's never been seen as a funny actor or a funny guy, and so he was a bit worried about obviously having to be hilarious for SNL. Yeah.
I didn't love that skit with him falling over the stairs and saying it was so hard. I mean, I don't love SNL, sorry to put that out there. I think we've said this on air before. I don't know if it's specifically tailored to more American humour.
I think it is.
It's not for me.
I think you've got to be really into American politics also. Not so much the celebrity ones, but I think 10% of SNL is really funny. Some of their skits are very funny, as I keep saying. The lesbian period drama skit is one of the all-time greats. And the male feminist in a bar, very good. If you're interested in the behind the scenes of SNL, Curtis Sittenfield's romantic comedy, really fun book. Did I ever lend that to you?
Oh, the one with the yellow cover?
Yes.
No, you didn't. But I would like to read that. So if you could, that would be brilliant.
About a woman who's one of the head writers on SNL who falls in love with one of the world's most famous who comes to do one of the SNL skits.
I know, that sounds like so ours. I'm really surprised that I haven't read it. And it was everywhere when it came out. So I must take
that. Lots of people were quite snooty about it, but I thought it was good. Yeah.
Well, if you liked it and other people are snooty, I will disregard the snoot.
As Madame Snoot over here. To finish, Cathers, let's reward the Huns who have made it through to the end. We like to save our juiciest bits for the very end. I have some very funny rumours to share with you about Paul Mescal, which have been blowing up on TikTok, and I was alerted to them by a younger member of the office. Paul Mescal apparently likes to go on dates with women, but then after they sleep together the next morning, he likes to suggest going on a walk, at which point, whilst they're walking around the park, he will just leg it.
So I've seen this, but I thought it was just a joke because he always looks like he's walking shiftily through London trying to get somewhere fast. So I assumed that it was just people's imaginative take on why he's shiftily racing through London all the time because he's trying to escape the gal from the night before.
So I
didn't think that was actually real.
So I thought this as well. But then I have someone who has been working with people that know him, and apparently he has a bit of a reputation for getting around.
Well, who could blame him after normal people? You would take that opportunity, wouldn't you?
Apparently he likes a crowded date, if you know what I mean.
A polyamorous date. Is that what you mean? Well, a crowded date?
Just a threesome is what I mean.
Sorry, I needed a little more.
I was trying to be respectful. He likes several women on the go. Ooh. And apparently there is some truth to the legging it rumours, which I find absurd. And also there's some really funny pictures of now. There's like people have found pictures where like a girl has like caught up with him.
I mean, like, where have you gone?
Yeah, like a girl is like running after him desperately.
Stop.
And it's like, oh my God, one finally caught up with Paul.
Oh my God.
But yeah, there are loads of pictures of him running around London.
Right.
But he just might also be on a run, you know, so.
It's possible.
But also I don't like, I'm sure it's just a stupid rumour, but it's funny if it's true.
Well, such weird things come from pap shots, don't they? Like one of the things that Jacob Elordi touched on is when he was photographed with bare feet and he said he'd actually just been surfing, but it prompted like 1,000 think pieces about Barefoot Boy Summer.
Hello.
And he was like, I just went surfing.
Journalists
it wasn't a fashion choice.
Just I'm so tragic. Like, I am embarrassed.
Barefoot Boy Summer. That makes me actually want to like just shrivel up and die.
Literally. But I think if we imagine that the rumour is real, unlikely, but just for the sake of this conversation, how would that work? Like, surely if you were on a date and your date started running away, you would run after them.
Yeah, well, I don't know, because it would be so mortifying.
You would just
if I knew that they were trying to escape me, then I certainly wouldn't run after them because my ego would be so bruised that I'd have to go home immediately. But if I thought it was just a case of losing them in the busy Soho streets, then I'd be like, hey, wait up.
If he maybe has social anxiety about telling a girl to get out of his house, which I think that is a massive thing, as people don't often know how to tell people to leave after a one night stand.
I know, but if you're Paul Mescal, come on, you've got quite a few excuses up your sleeve. Got filming.
Yeah.
You're busy.
Yeah. I guess.
Got your PR coming round. I mean, there is an infinite well of excuses.
That's
you could
true.
Use
also, you could
Hollywood
literally
star.
Get your assistant to come round to have them out. But I think also if you're dating Paul Mescal, you certainly don't want to be leaving the house, do you?
Probably just locking in for the long haul.
I think what's missing here.
I'm sorry, I'm ill. I can't leave.
Oh, is that my removal ban around the corner? I think the issue is we haven't yet heard from the source. Can someone let us know?
Does anyone know Paul Mescal or know someone who knows someone who knows someone who knows Paul Mescal?
Has someone been on a date with Paul Mescal?
We do often get good gossip. We got excellent gossip about Shawn Mendes from a listener
We did.
But it's probably not shareable, or we may get done for libel.
Yeah. Do you think we ever will get done for libel?
I don't know. I hope not.
Yeah.
I was a bit concerned with the Princess Beatrice slicing Ed Sheeran around the face anecdote, just because I did think that the royal family, if anyone was going to do it, could come after us.
Yes, quite lucky that my boss at Telegraph made me write up that story.
And get it legaled.
And therefore it got legaled. And it was fine.
We knew we were safe.
But also I have a lawyer friend who I did send the Naomi Campbell human trafficking thing to.
Oh, did you? Good, because I got a bit worried about that, because no. I feel like Naomi is the kind of person that would.
She was like, as long as you say... It came allegedly, from this tweet. Allegedly. The tweet says, right. We're not saying, the tweet says. Right. Yes, a little intel for any of you guys. Guys, can I just make a plea right now for all of you who've enjoyed this episode to just go and send it to a friend who would like to join our community?
Please. Bring in the other pop culture honeys.
Yeah, so just send it to a friend or two. Press follow on Spotify and do leave a review.
We'll love you forever.
We will. And it's worth saying as well that we are getting a steady stream of very personal and lovely and vulnerable DMs about the difficulties of motherhood, the highs and lows for our Why is No One Having Children special.
The big kids question.
So do keep sending them in, because I think it'd be really helpful to have a great diversity of experiences. So we'd
for
love
sure.
to read out as many as possible, anonymously, of course.
Yeah. Honeys, thank you for listening. As always, we are so grateful and appreciative of you, and we love you forever. See
Bye.
You next week.